Hello, and welcome to another edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us on this Monday. Not quite as oppressively hot as it has been in the past. Enjoy it as you listen to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM, your community radio station, right here in Kansas City. The fringe has concluded, I think. Is there anything left? Is there anything left to see? I don't know. I suppose that's possible, but that's one of the things that will undoubtedly come up on as the course of the program unfolds here today. But lots of things going on in the area. Today we're going to talk to someone who sees a lot of theater. Boy, does this gentleman see a lot of theater. His name is Alan Portner. He's an online critic. His website is BroadwayWorld.com, and you can read all kinds of information about all kinds of productions. He has the schedules of the upcoming theaters. You name it, he has it. He has written for publications for over 40 years, has published daily newspapers as far east as Washington, D.C., where he has press credentials, by the way, and as far west as Honolulu, Hawaii. Currently, this is a new one on me, working on a book about a literary partnership between Ulysses S. Grant and Mark Twain. So we'll love to hear the lowdown of what you want to say about that. But his website is BroadwayWorld.com. His name is Alan Portner. Welcome back once again to the Arts Magazine Show. How are you doing?
I'm, other than being all fringed out, I'm doing great, Michael. How are you?
How many fringe shows did you end up seeing, do you estimate?
I actually saw 9 fringe shows and reviewed 8 of them. It was... Plus, we had something rotten out at Starlight this week, and something rotten was anything but rotten. Very, very, very funny show. Oddly enough, Something Rotten closed January 1st, 2017, on Broadway, and these guys were having such a great time. They packed it up and they took it on the road. So the people that just closed yesterday at Starlight were the Broadway cast.
Really?
Yeah. So it was exceptionally good.
So, but that must be tempting for a critic. I guess you liked the show.
I did.
From what you said. But Something Rotten. Isn't that tempting to latch on to something like that? I just remember there was a movie years back called Opportunity Knocks. I think Dana Carvey was the main performer in the show. And oh, did some of the critics have fun with their criticism of Opportunity Knocks. Cool. I remember reading very distinctly, Opportunity Knocked, but no one was home. But things like that.
You go for the cheap stuff once in a while. You know, at one point in my life, I was an actor, and people told me that I should be on the stage. They told me there was one leaving very shortly. So those who can do, those who can't write about it. So here I am.
And you've been writing about it for a long, long time.
I have been. Yeah. I have been. Not 40 years, 50 years, actually.
Wow.
The first play I ever reviewed was a Taste of Honey, way back in 1967, I believe.
Wow.
So, a long time ago.
Was Troy Donahue in that? In my mind, I saw Troy Donahue when you mentioned that title.
You know, he may have been. I doubt it. Mm-hmm. It was about an African American sailor who had fallen in love with an Anglo girl, taking place in England, I believe.
Yeah.
So I doubt that Troy. Unless they did it on radio, I doubt that he was in it.
Oh, I'm retracting and I'm getting off subject, but I read an article recently about Troy Donahue, the now late Troy Donahue, of course. Made quite a splash, ended up being homeless for periods of his life, and overextended himself to a great deal, was married to Suzanne Flechette, for one, married several times. Talk about the ups and downs of a career, but I guess that's typical of performers.
It is. It's a very tough life. Here in Kansas City, we're very fortunate to have a great acting community and some really good people. But I'll tell you, if you're in the big time, there are ups and there are downs, and there are many more downs than there are ups.
So many of them tell me that they moved or decided to settle in this area because it was much easier to get work here than it was on either the East or West Coast.
Yeah, I believe that's true. There's something like, I want to say something like 45 producing companies here in the Kansas City area, and most of them have some relationship with Actors Equity, mm-hmm. Which is now AGFA, I believe. The office here closed, I believe it's in, now in St. Louis, but there's just a tremendous amount of opportunity here, and people get work.
The same thing happened with SAG-AFTRA, mm-hmm. which I'm in, and we don't have a local office. The closest one is in St. Louis, and there are rumors that the St. Louis office might end up going to the Chicago area as well. So they're doing a lot of consolidating.
Yeah, they are. It's a very, very difficult. It's something that's so much fun and so many people want to do it that it just becomes a very, very competitive and difficult thing to be into. Mm-hmm. I think as most actors get older, most of them end up on the business side of the thing. Tom Hanks is a great example. Mel Gibson, who turned out not to be as nice a person as we had all hoped. He ended up with his own company. I just saw The Crucible a couple of weeks ago, and you're wondering why I brought that up. It's because The Crucible is, of course, a reaction to the McCarthy hearings in the 50s, and the House Un-American Activities Committee in the 50s, and a lot of people had their careers ruined through that episode, and you're still wondering where I'm going with this. And the truth is that Kirk Douglas, when he did Spartacus, broke the back of the McCarthy committee by insisting that Dalton Trumbo, who was blacklisted, put his name on the movie, and in fact broke the back of the blacklist.
Yeah.
So another example of a big time actor who ended up being a big time producer.
Yeah. Yeah. Politics ebb and flow. Arthur Miller, I guess he saw the opportunity. I suppose he didn't want to do a play about the McCarthy hearings up front, but he did in his own way.
Well, he did, and they got back at him in 1956 when they held him in contempt of Congress. Because he refused to name names.
Yeah.
Who knows? Something like that may be happening again as as we're trying to stop leaks and we want people to name names.
Yeah.
So it's appropriate that that play is being performed again.
Sure. Well, as Alan pointed out, there's a lot of theaters in the area, a lot of paid jobs in the theater. There's a lot of community theaters as well, mm-hmm. quite a few, and I talk to a lot of these people, but with the professional theaters, there's a lot of them, and they've all managed to survive so far.
They do.
I guess, but it's always a struggle.
It is.
It's always a struggle. But I mentioned Fringe.
Fringe.
Fringe is something. It's been around for a while. What did we say last time?
13 years, I believe.
13 years. It started a lot smaller than it is now, but mm-hmm. it's really substantially grown. So just in general, I will ask, what do you think?
Well, it goes back to the 1940s. Not here, but it goes back to the 1940s in Edinburgh, Scotland. And oddly enough, we think of Fringe and we think of things that are kind of far out, and we think of things that are sometimes a little more adult than other shows. The opportunity to be a little wilder than normal. But actually, Fringe just meant it was on the fringe of London. In the 1940s after the war, the Edinburgh International Theatre Festival did not have room for all the people that wanted to participate, and there were 8 groups that showed up, and they found venues around Edinburgh, Scotland, and lo and behold, that became the first Fringe Festival, and Now there are fringe festivals on all six continents. I don't think there's one in Antarctica, but other than that, I believe there's one, at least one in every continent. It's big in Australia. It's big in New Zealand. It's big here in the United States. There's probably 50 of them, and in Canada, and in South America. And here we had this year 90 different performances, of which 48 were scripted shows, I believe, and 17 were out-of-town actors and producers who brought their shows into town to show them off. And some of them are really, really good, and some of them are not so much.
The scripted ones, overall, I would say the scripted ones are probably better than the more off-the-cuff type presentations.
Well, I think that's true. I also think a lot of the comedians are pretty good. We saw, among other things, we saw the Art of Magic, which I think is chapter number 38 here in town, but there are two magical organizations here, and one of the things that's most impressive about these particular people is they react to audiences very well, and they've got their patter down just like that, and after the show they kind of, you should excuse the expression, disappear for a while.
Yeah, well, these things happen. Like I say, I did a show, it's been years now, but it's still pertinent, of course. One of the guests was talking about Orson Welles.
Orson Welles
was subbing for Johnny Carson one night. Actually revealed how two tricks, I believe it was two, not just one. Could be wrong about that. But he at least revealed how one trick was done. Of course, he was immediately protested by magician organizations, saying people were making their living, perhaps including this particular trick, which you've now exposed to a national audience. Why, Mr. Welles, did you do such a thing? You wanted to have a good showing on the Carson show as the substitute host, but why did you do this? Why did you hurt the livelihood of these magicians? And he just brushed it off. I guess he didn't care. Do you have a reaction to that?
I understand if you reveal their tricks, what happens is they curse you.
Yes.
Forever. And not having the ability or the fortitude to withstand a curse, I'm not going to comment at all.
Yeah, okay.
The comedians are often very good because, once again, some of them far, far, far out on the fringe, and others of them are very well practiced, and they do a fine job. There was a gentleman who we see every year here named Tim Mooney from the Tim Rooney Repertory Theater. He's a one-man show, and he's been doing this for years, and he changes the show every so often. But Tim did a thing called Breakneck Julius Caesar, which was just super. I just can't imagine. All these shows are an hour long, and I can't imagine the difficulty of being able to stand on a stage in a toga and keep everybody's attention for an hour playing about 20 characters. But Tim manages to do it and does a great job. And went through five acts of William Shakespeare in an hour with a timer on the stage and finished in 59 minutes and 30 seconds. Yes. And the funny thing is he spent a great deal of time paying homage to the actual material. It wasn't all comedy. There was some breaking of the fourth wall and showing us some slides so we can see where all this took place and the audience stabbed him at least once with a rubber sword, but he did honor to the material, and that's pretty special to be able to do that for an hour.
Well, it sounds like that was very well written and well prepared.
Yeah.
I've seen things that frankly didn't seem to be written at all, may even have been made up on the spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. some things are experimental. Heidi Vann did something called Liminal State, I believe, with seven or eight women on stage. It was essentially a dance piece, but it wasn't. It was totally experimental in nature, and although I had a hard time following it myself, I could appreciate the artistry that went into it.
Yeah, yeah. Talking with critic Alan Portner. He is author of several books. He's working on one now. He's very well known for his book of puns. If you know Alan, you're often entertained by little puns once in a while, and later on we'll let him perhaps read some passages or whatever he would like to do.
Well, you know, it took quite some time, but I did spend a little bit of time in the punitentiary.
But you seem to love that.
I do.
You slipped him in there all the time. It's quite entertaining, actually.
Thank you. I enjoy it. I have a book at home, which is, how would I explain it? It's actually a workbook. It's something to help you do this, and it's called Get Thee to a Punnery. It's Shakespeare loved puns. He was. They used to claim it was the lowest form of humor. I would argue that.
They can go even lower than that.
You can go lower than that, yes.
But quite an author, has worked in and published in a number of locations, but I'm getting ahead of myself. We need to talk more about, is there anything more you want to say about The Fringe before I...
It's a tremendous organizational challenge. They do a fine job with that. Some of the shows are great. Some of them aren't so good. You pay your money, your $10. You take your chances, and many times you're rewarded with a gem. Occasionally, you're rewarded with the pit at the center of the prune. But I saw some good stuff this time. And if anyone's interested, I would. Invite them to go to BroadwayWorld.com and take a good look at some of the reviews, and you may find some things that you want to see.
Sure, yeah. See, that's the thing. You have a choice of so many things. I know people who saw one thing at 7 p.m., another thing at 9 p.m., just really went for it.
They did.
But you can do that in something like that, because they are an hour apart usually, and the theaters are, the venues, I should say, are sometimes close together. They're in various clusters, mm-hmm. but you can attend things.
Well, they were in Crown Center at Musical Theater Heritage. They were at Union Station. They were at the Unicorn. They were at the Arts Asylum. Some people actually were let out of the Arts Asylum. There were other people who were... Which is,
so that was a good one, right?
Yeah. There were, let's see, where else were they? They were at the Phosphor Studio. They were at the Buffalo Room. They were all over the place. They were even at the Writers' Center.
I remember early on, some people tried to compete with The Fringe, and they've ended mm-hmm. up over the years joining The Fringe. Mm-hmm. That's probably the easier way to go about it.
I suspect it is. Suspect it is.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of theaters in the area. And I suppose Alan and I will probably talk about most of them. Do you have an order in mind? We can go in your order. We don't have to go.
You know,
in my order.
I'm going to go through some things that I've seen recently, and there have been some excellent things. The Crucible, again, I think is very appropriate to look at now.
Does the young audience of today, do they get that? Do they really think we're talking about, you know, witchcraft and all of that, or do they get what it's really about? I find that I have found some people not knowledgeable of that.
Well, it sometimes you can't tell which witch is which.
See, then what did I tell you?
Okay. But, you know, I remember studying The Crucible in high school.
Yeah, we did too.
And I remember it being Goody this and Two Shoes that, and the Puritans back in the 1650s. I have actually been to Salem They don't allow smoking there anymore. There were actually 13 people killed, I believe, and there were 160 charged with witchcraft at the time. And basically a teenager would come up and accuse somebody and they would be charged.
Yeah.
And there was a big trial, and as I say, 13 people were actually, I believe they were hung. I don't believe they were burned at the stake.
Yeah.
But I understand here in Kansas City, one was actually burned, or that could have been a Kansas City stake. Yeah. It's hard to tell.
Could have been a local politician, for that matter. Who knows?
Could have been. Could have been.
But Arthur Miller was clever enough to do that symbolically.
He was. He was.
That was probably the right choice.
And this went from the late 40s to, well, I know Miller himself was charged with contempt of Congress in 56. There were two organizations. There was the House Un-American Activities Committee, which goes back, believe it or not, to the 30s or the 20s, and then there was the Judiciary Committee, I believe, which is what McCarthy was actually part of. He was the junior senator from Wisconsin at the time. And again, they just ruined a bunch of people, and they would call them in. And you may remember the Jim Carrey movie, one of his best, The Majestic, which had the same subject matter. And it was a horrible time.
And
now that we're worried about fake news, we're kind of back in the same place again. So maybe it's time to look at what can happen with the Salem witch trials and think about it again.
Yeah, that was very clever. Authors over the years have done that
Absolutely. In
various ways, man. And it most of the time it works out. I think sometimes mm-hmm. it doesn't.
I understand that that Hamlet from the Shakespeare Festival this year, the Heart of America Shakespeare Festival, did a great job. And going back to Something Rotten, it's just a. Did you get to see Something Rotten, Michael?
No.
Well, let me tell you about it.
Well, do please.
Okay. It's about two brothers, Nick and Nigel Bottom. The time is 1595, and they are a struggling theatrical company, and they are in competition with William Shakespeare. And they can't understand why Shakespeare is coming up with all their ideas, and even a lot of their dialogue. And it turns out that William Shakespeare is actually their patron in disguise, and he's stealing all their ideas. Mm-hmm. Well, their backer is a gentleman named Shylock.
Oh,
yes.
Well, then.
Who is a banker, but he really wants to be in show business. He wants to join Ethel Merman and the crew and become and get into show business. And the Bottoms are struggling to come up with an idea. So they hire a fortune teller. First they go to the Soothsayer Alley, and they go to the first soothsayer and discover a sign on his shop, which says that he can't be there because of unforeseen circumstances, which doesn't speak real well for a soothsayer. So they went to their second choice, who was a gentleman named Nostradamus. Not that Nostradamus, but his nephew, Thomas Nostradamus. And his idea is that instead of writing a tragedy or a comedy, these guys should indeed write a musical. And that's the beginning of musical theater, according to the show. It's really, really funny. Mm-hmm. And great music, great dance, lots of tap dancing in a 1595 musical. It's a lot of fun. Anyway, I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but at the end of the show, the Puritans, again with the Salem witch trials, they're gonna kill off all the people that they think have offended them. They're going to behead them, And that includes Shylock, and it includes the Nigel and Nick and the Puritan minister's daughter, Portia. They're given a choice. They can either be transported to the New World, or they can be beheaded. So, of course, they all go. And Shylock is much more welcome in the New Amsterdam theatrical community. And musical comedy caught on. It's a very funny bit, and I liked it a lot. Then out at New Theater right now, we have the Million Dollar Quartet, which is just a great show, and they do a nice job out at New Theater. It's the story, a true story, roughly. That goes back to about 1956, when just so happened to Sun Music, you had Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins and Elvis Presley all showing up at the same day at the same time, and they indeed had a jam session that ran all day, and Sam Phillips, the owner of Sun Records, was smart enough to record it and released it 35 years later as a show, and it actually is an album, and it later ended up on Broadway. Of course, all the principals except for Jerry Lee Lewis are long gone, but it's a fun show, and I recommend it if somebody's looking for something fun to do on a weekday or weekend night.
Sure. So we've covered, we sort of covered the Fringe, the Shakespeare Festival, the New Theater. When we return from our break, we have a break coming up. Incredibly enough, we're already almost through the first half of the program. We have a lot more to talk about. So I probably shouldn't ask Alan any side questions. I was, when he was talking about Shakespeare, I the lady from UMKC, Felicia Landre, well-known dramaturg, she has actually written her opinions on whether Shakespeare actually wrote all of his own plays again. And she thinks he did not. If you go to one of her lectures, you will learn that. But anyway, more questions from Alan Fortner. He's from BroadwayWorld.com. You can read his opinions of the Fringe shows, if you wish. Other shows that he's talked about. Shows that he is going to talk about in the next half hour. Lots of ground to cover, so I probably should shut up and let him do it. All of that. When we return, you're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM. Yeah, some well-known nephews might be on the show as well. Welcome back to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hoger, host. We're speaking with Alan Portner today. He is an online critic and author of A Book of Puns, has written for publications for over 50 years. Boy, as far east as Washington, D.C., where I mentioned earlier he has press credentials, probably still good even to this day, and as far west as Honolulu, Hawaii. What a cultural difference that
yes,
must
it is.
Have been. Did you pick articles differently based on what would go in Hawaii as far as what would go in Washington, D.C.?
You know, not so much. Hawaii is just a marvelous place. I would go back in a minute and a half. It's one of my favorite places to be in the entire world.
Yeah. His website is BroadwayWorld.com. You can check it out right now as you listen to us and see Alan's opinions on things. We've talked about the Fringe Festival. We've talked about the New Theater. We've talked about the Shakespeare Festival. But there's a lot of places to cover. Where would you like to go to first? Metropolitan Ensemble Theater is right down the street. The Unicorn and the Met are right down up north of us. What's going on there?
Let's talk about the Met. And starting on September 14th, we have Antigone, which is the penultimate conclusion to the Odyssey, to the Ulysses cycle, and then the Weir, beginning on October 1st, and Cymbeline, which is a Shakespeare, on
November 9th. They've got a huge, huge season coming up. It's a Wonderful Life is there. Then I think we've got Defying Gravity and Anna in the Tropics. And then they finish up the year with the Unsinkable Molly Brown.
Oh, wow.
So I think it's going to be a Titanic season for them.
I haven't seen that one since it was at Starlight Theater years ago.
Harve Presnell in the lead, one of the who just passed away, oddly enough. He was, you may remember him as General Marshall in Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, sure.
Just a wonderful voice.
For those of you who don't know the subject of that, it is quite interesting. Molly Brown was a very wealthy woman, but she happened to be on the Titanic at the time it went down.
She was, and she survived. She was married to Johnny Brown from Leadville, Colorado. She was kind of a dance hall girl, and Johnny Brown found a bunch of silver, and she became extremely rich, and she was kind of shunned by the nouveau riche because Molly was quite a lady, but she had she didn't have a lot of culture.
They worked her character in. I don't, literary license wise, can you do this? They worked her character into the movie The Titanic.
They did.
Yeah,
they did. And actually, she was there, and I think ended up living in Denver. As a matter of fact, quite a fascinating lady. And if you've ever been to Leadville, it's a wild town. It's almost 2 miles high.
Oh.
It's an interesting place to visit if you're out in Colorado. I recommend it highly.
Well, sure. Now, the Met, they would like to move. Do you have anything late on any of that?
I have nothing late. I've seen the plans. As a matter of fact, they are planning on moving almost directly underneath this radio station to the Warwick Theater.
Uh-huh.
And it's several millions of dollars they need to raise in order to make that all come true. I'm very hopeful they'll get it done.
Yeah. Theaters are always moving. I know the previously mentioned Barn Players have moved as well. They're no longer in Johnson County.
They're in Mission.
They were in Mission.
Uh-huh. And I guess the Barn is going to become a parking lot to the Credit Union next door, and they are moving down to, at least for the adult shows, they're moving to the Arts Asylum, which has just been redone entirely and it's been acoustically enhanced, and there is new seating, so it's a little bit bigger venue, and it's a nice venue. It's close to downtown.
I was going to ask, acoustically speaking, for their needs. They do a lot of musicals. Their more successful shows are usually musicals. Not that the ones that are not musicals are not successful, but they seem to be more successful at the musicals.
More people. More people in them. More families, sure, to come visit. Yeah, I think that's true. And the Barn is 65 years old.
Oh, at least. It may be more.
Yeah.
I can remember, well, I won't go into that, yeah, but a long time ago.
Yeah, there's a certain loft to the Barn Players.
Being one of the, either one or two of the oldest community theaters in the area, the other one being, of course, the Bell Road Barn. Which one is actually the oldest? I'm not sure.
I'm not either.
Bell Road Barn in Parkville. They've moved several times over the years. Justin David began that. Those of you who remember Jenny Fulpiano from the Milgram's commercials back when Milgram's was a thriving grocery chain here in the area. His daughter, Jenny Fulpiano, was one of the spokespeople, along with Dick Brown, who is still around doing things, despite his partial paralysis. It's quite remarkable, I think, Dick.
And then there's another new theater that's going in, quite an impressive place, I'm told. Music Theater Kansas City, which, not to be confused with Musical Theater Heritage, evidently has a connection with the people who have the B&B movie theaters.
Oh.
And in the Shawnee 16-plex, they have been given one of the 16 theaters to turn into a legitimate house, and it's, I think I remember reading it's a $4 million project, and they have to come up with $1 million out for the stage house. Mm-hmm. So that's coming along, and the B&B folks have been very very supportive of their efforts. And there are just tremendous numbers of training facilities and classes and beyond just the 45 producing companies. And that does not include the 25 collegiate-level programs that are here and the Lord knows how many high school programs.
Oh, yeah. Quite a few. And you end up seeing a lot of them.
Yeah, I do. We now have three writers for Broadway World here in Kansas City, and I do all the scheduling, but there's just no way that I could see 250 shows a year. That's oh. not including the high school and not including the collegiate programs.
There's a lot of venues in Kansas City. Will we reach the point where perhaps there's too many?
I know that there's some people that are concerned about that, but you know, I don't think so. I think a lot of it has to do with Starlight and to do with the fabulous lady that started the Missouri Repertory Theater, now the Kansas City Repertory Theater. Her name was.
Okay, you got me.
it was an Irish or a Scottish name.
Yes, I remember meeting her. She was quite proud of that, and she was especially proud when they moved into the facility where they are now.
I think she was, and I know that
Patricia McElrath. I knew it would come.
and I know that that she was the genesis of the Unicorn with Cynthia Levin, and several other of the theaters. I think Casey Actors Theater generates from her, and I think the new theater generates from her. So between that and the 8,000 some odd seats out at Starlight, my goodness gracious, it just was something that people in Kansas City did, and as a result, all these theaters have continued to thrive and grow, and it's. I was amazed when we retired here from Washington, D.C. I think there's probably more theater in Kansas City than there is in Washington, D.C.
Well, at theatrical houses, anyway. There's mm-hmm. there's a lot of theater in Washington, D.C.
There is indeed.
There certainly is, of course.
There is indeed.
Boy, Musical Theater Heritage, we should mention. That's mm-hmm. one of your main stops as well.
It is. Founded by... by George Harder. George is a fine man. Started this, ran a radio show talking about musical theater for 35 years. Still, as the founder of Musical Theater Heritage, they started as a concert operation. For those of you who on PBS have seen either Les Miserables or have seen Phantom of the Opera on the PBS version that comes from the Royal Albert Hall in London. That's kind of what Musical Theater Heritage started as, and then it just grew into other things. They do 190 performances a year of various things. They have their Musical Monday programs. They have their weekend programs. They have their main stage programs. I think this year they're expanding to 5 main stage programs over the course of the year. The quality of the performances are great, and there are certain things that I have seen there that are certainly as good as anything you will see anywhere. I just saw Tommy there. And Tommy was originally written by The Who, which I guess is an Australian rock group, and back in the 1960s, 70s. And it originally was set up to be a concert story or an album. And this venue, this method of doing a musical play with lots of lights and lots of dance and lots of microphones and very little scenery just seems to work for this kind of show extremely well. I saw what I would think is probably the best version of Jesus Christ Superstar I've ever seen there. And again, Andrew Lloyd Webber hated it on Broadway because it was originally designed to be an album. It was a concept. It was it was something that they designed back in he and Tim Rice did in the 60s. And it was this is as close to what the original intention was as anything you'll ever see. Mm-hmm. They did a great job.
Yeah. We mentioned the Unicorn several times. They do a certain kind of show.
They do, and many of their shows are part of a rolling national premiere. A lot of them are new. Some not so much. I think I've got here a list of some of the shows that they're going to be doing this year.
One of them can't be mentioned on the air. I saw that list earlier. So when we do that interview, we'll kind of talk around that.
We have Men on Boats, Disgraced, the one we can't mention, Chesapeake, Informed Consent, Viet Gong, which I imagine is a Vietnam venue kind of thing. And An Octoroon is another show they're going to be doing there this year. And I think with the two theaters, I think something is almost always running there. And and the quality of the material, they tend towards straight plays. The quality of the material is exceptional. Mm-hmm. In many cases, and I encourage people to go to either the Levin stage or the Jerome stage, I believe, over there.
Yeah. Yeah. Both in the same. They, if you're thinking, how does that work? Yes, they stagger the times.
They do,
and the intermission. So yes, you can have two shows going on in there at the same time, and they sometimes do.
They do. They do. It's excellent. I think, of course, we have to go to and talk about the Kansas City Repertory Theater.
Of course,
they just do really, really good stuff. Between the Lines is a new play that I don't know much about, but opens on September 8th. It's a full musical. Fences, the August Wilson play that was just. I guess originally on Broadway it was James Earl Jones in it, and we just had a movie version with Denzel Washington. A Christmas Carol, of course, they've done for 36, 37 years, usually with Gary Neal Johnson as Scrooge. And my favorite last year was Victor Wexler Rader as Marley's ghost. He was, and Victor, you may remember from Seinfeld, where he was George Costanza's proctologist, I believe.
And King of Queens, where he was Carrie's boss in two different generations, shall we say. He was Carrie's boss, and later on, Carrie needed another boss, and the producer said, it worked with Victor. Let's bring Victor back as a different character, and he's Carrie's boss again.
And Victor's just fun to be around. Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, again. Sex with Strangers. They're going to do Sweeney Todd this coming year. One of my favorite shows from Stephen Sondheim.
Well, that's the one where the audience picks the ending, right?
No, you're thinking about Sheer Madness.
Okay.
We're talking about Sweeney Todd is an early 19th century melodrama that I learned about in my theater history class back in college. And if you want to see a movie version of it, Johnny Depp and Tim, what's Tim's last name?
Burton.
Tim Burton's wife. Carter is her name, I believe. They were excellent in this thing. Alan Rickman is the mean judge. They were great. So I recommend that, and I also recommend you go see the Casey Rep version of that. They do a great job. They really do.
Who else would you like to hit? We're down to like 10 minutes, and there's so much to talk about.
There is.
Who would you like to give a mention out to?
Well, I've already mentioned New Theater, but I will tell you that coming up on September 27th through the end of November, we have Driving Miss Daisy.
Ah, yes.
Now, Miss Daisy is many of their shows. The main character will be in some kind of a secondary role. However, in this version of Driving Miss Daisy, we have Michael Learned, Mama Walton, as Miss Daisy, and Charles Robinson, who you may remember is from one of my favorite all-time situation comedies, Night Court, as Mac, will be playing the Morgan Freeman character. Patty Duke Austin's husband, John, was, of course, Harry's father in Night Court. And I always remember that he always would talk about that, except for that he was a little crazy, and he would talk about that, except for that little setback with the Cheese Whiz. He's doing much better now. He just completely.
Yeah, he unfortunately for his career, he got stuck as the... Mr. Adams from the Adams Family. That's most people remember him from that role.
He's actually 91 or 92 now, and he's a graduate of the University of Maryland, and he's still teaching theater there.
Wow!
So he's quite a guy. Then they're going to do Barefoot in the Park out at New Theater, and Sister Act the Musical, and Mamma Mia. Yeah. So. There's some good things coming out there, and again, you know, there's just so much you just can't hardly even get to it all.
Just a quick, only a few minutes. Community theaters around town. Sometimes you go there as well.
Yes, I will do the Barn, or I will do the City Theater of Independence, or we will do the Theater in the Park, or the Theater in the Park up in Gladstone, or the Summit Players, or, my goodness, there are just so many of them, it's hard. There's one up in Excelsior Springs.
Oh, yeah.
There's, and we try to get to all of them. The Coterie is always a lot of fun. They always do good shows.
Theater for Young America.
Theater for Young America. Although those are mainly school programs, I think, for the most part, and they're almost you don't see a lot of them, but they do wonderful things, and I recommend them highly. Like I say, there are tremendous amounts of talent and tremendous amounts of performance, and there's my wife. Very often will approach me and ask me, she will beg me to take her to a movie so she can see a play without live actors.
That's right. Interesting, isn't it? Interesting how that is. Okay, I want to get to these things. Your book of puns and the project you're working on. Boy, a literary partnership between Ulysses S. Grant and Mark Twain. What a timing.
Well, lots of folks wanted Ulysses Grant to write a memoir, and he always refused. He always said that Adam Badeau, who was one of his generals, Brevet Brigadier General, and was with him during most of the war, at least the end of the war, had written an extended biography of Grant, and he decided that he didn't want to do that. But in 1880... three or four, his son had gotten him involved with the man who ended up being the 19th century version of Bernie Madoff.
Oh.
And they got involved in a
Ponzi scheme that basically took all Grant's money and $15 million, which at that point in time was a lot of money, from a lot of his friends and a lot of the people that respected Grant. And lo and behold, at almost the same moment in time, he discovered that he was ill. He was ill with throat cancer, and in fact died in 1885, just 8 or 10 months later. Well, it turns out that there was a gentleman who you may never have heard of named Robert Underwood Johnson. Mr. Johnson had a number of incredible friends, among them John Muir, and he was very much involved in creating the conservation movement, among them Nikola Tesla, who, of course, was the man who invented many, many things, but he invented alternating current. Among them was Mark Twain. And Johnson was, in addition to being a poet, was an editor of a publication called The Century. And he and one of his partners decided to do a book called the Civil War by the leaders of the various armies, and one of the people he approached was Grant. Well, Mark Twain, who was a wonderful writer and an interesting character, but not the most ethical person that ever lived, stole the Grant book from him. Grant decided to write the book because he needed a way to leave his family an inheritance, and in fact finished the book 5 days before he died. Wow. in August of 1885. The book ended up being a big success. They sold, it's a two-volume set, and they sold 750,000 volumes in a country with only 50 million people at that time. And it's a fascinating story. Mark Twain was a very, very interesting character. He was somebody that you got to know very well through his writings, and most of his stuff is autobiographical in one way or another. He was very involved in the copyright movement and worked very hard to get the first copyright laws passed in the United States. And he died in had some very hard luck. His wife died in 1904. His daughter died at Christmas in 1909. She was an epileptic, and she drowned in the bathtub in their home.
Oh, wow.
In Reading, Pennsylvania, outside Reading, Pennsylvania. And he never recovered and died the following April.
Now, when can we expect perhaps to see this book?
Oh, hopefully before Twain is reborn. I continue to work on it. It's over a 35-year period, and it's a very difficult subject area. And I'm looking very hard at making our friend Mr. Johnson, who was present for the entire span of time, into the protagonist. He lived into the 1940s, and was one of the founders of the American Academy of Literary Arts. Mm-hmm. In New York, and Twain was also one of the founders. He was an interesting character, and was indeed at Twain's funeral in April of 1910.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming. We're less than a minute. BroadwayWorld.com. You can see a lot of Alan's work, what he thinks of things, and what's coming up, things of that nature, on BroadwayWorld.com.
And if you want to audition, there are
audition notices as well.
Are there as well. This is not just my book or my site. It's a national site.
Sure. Thanks so much for being with us. See how easy it was to do. I could do another hour easily, but you probably have to go. And the Jazz Insider is with us as well. He's going to be playing jazz from 1 to 3. Then we'll have the blues from 3 to 6 right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's Community Radio. Alan Portner, BroadwayWorld.com. Thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you, Michael.
So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hoge. We'll see you.